Thank you very much. And yeah, delighted to be here today and to be joined by the panel members this afternoon. And special thank you to Alan and to Ruth for stepping in at very short notice. We were due to be joined by Michael Reeve and Dr. Ian Livingston, who sadly both were unable to join us this afternoon. So I'm very grateful to Alan and Ruth for stepping in this afternoon. My name is Tara. I work on behalf of the Scottish Government, leading a programme that's all focused on digital inclusion, supporting people to access digital technology as part of health and social care. I'm actually from Elgin, in the northeast of Scotland. I'm 5'7". I've got dark hair and I'm all in black today as well. Lots of people are all in black today. And this afternoon, we're going to be discussing the latest developments and innovations specifically related to health and social care, which I'm sure you'll agree is a very rapidly evolving environment. I think joining the conference yesterday and today, personally, I've certainly been incredibly inspired by the technology and the innovation within this context. And I think there's so much we can learn when we're thinking about public sector services, especially within health and social care, to look at, you know, how we support inclusive design of our public services, particularly here in Scotland. And it is one of our priorities within our digital health and care strategy in Scottish Government is around digital access and how we support people to be digitally included as part of health and social care services online. And within the programme of work that I've been involved in, we've been working with 20 organisations across Scotland to look at how we can best support people to access the online world. And in August last year, Audit Scotland published a report on digital exclusion in Scotland and really highlighted the need for a clear focus from leadership and for public sector organisations to take responsibility for how we support people to be digitally included so that where people do choose to access digital services, that they are able to do so as part of their health and social care. So it's been a real exciting opportunity for me to be involved in this work with the different organisations across Scotland and seeing their different approaches to how they support digital inclusion across health and social care. And just to touch briefly on the, I think a lot of the themes that I've been hearing yesterday and today, it's thinking about how we actually introduce digital and technology as part of health and care and thinking about that motivation for people to engage with technology as part of the experience. And, you know, there's still a lot of fear that people have around using technology, particularly when it comes to their health and care, thinking about things like ethics and privacy, and how we really articulate that and make that transparent and clear to people around, you know, what we do with data and this type of thing. So that whole process of introducing people to technology and supporting them to confidently use technology as part of healthcare is something that we're really keen to see across Scotland as we introduce more digital ways of accessing services that go forward. So within this panel, particularly, we're really looking at, you know, how does technology empower patients to have greater control over their health and care? And you'll be hearing some examples from our panelists this afternoon around how they have been approaching that within their work. So if I can introduce, first of all, we have Nicola Cooper, who's joining us from Scottish Care. Nicola is the digital technology and innovation lead within Scottish Care and has been doing some fascinating work looking at innovative workforce roles, particularly the care technologist project. And I'll just pass over to Nicola to tell us a bit more about your work within Scottish Care. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tara. Oh, I'm very loud. And thanks for staying with us for this graveyard shift. It's been a great conference. I don't know about you, but I'm quite full and, lots of inspiration. I want to tell you that some time ago I was at an event and I was stood right next to Kylie Minogue. And I can confirm that I am exactly the same height as Kylie Minogue. I'm a little bit, slightly younger. I do also have blonde hair and I'm not wearing hot pants today. And on that note, we're going to play just a short video to introduce you to the care technologist role that Tara mentioned, and then I'll talk you through some of the thinking around that. So if we could just have the video, thanks.
How do you feel about technology? Do you find it makes things easier for you? Or is it too complicated to get your head around? Maybe you enjoy using technology, or maybe you find it infuriating. Well, what if I were to tell you there was someone on your care team whose job it was to explain what technology could be useful for you and even have to become familiar and confident with it? That's the project we're working on and I'd like to explain to you today. We're trying out a new role in the sector called the care technologist. The care technologist will be part of your care team and meet with you to talk about how you can use technology to help you live with more choice and freedom while still getting the support you need. You might already have some technology in your home, like a smartphone that helps you stay in touch with loved ones, do your online shop, or to look things up like a weather. Maybe you use a laptop or computer or have other technology to keep you entertained. You might have other devices that connect you to services like a community alarm, one that helps you have online appointments with your doctor. You might have Alexa, or another voice-activated system that allows you to play music, turn the lights and heating on off, all without having to physically get up and reach in the switch. So the first question your care technologist will ask is what you already have and what you use it for. Then a discussion about what you would like to be able to do will take place. So we will start exploring options and what might be of use to you. We understand that unfamiliar technology can be a bit daunting. So the rest assured, your care technologist will be there to support you all the way. We're not here to sell you devices either. So we'll look to overcome financial barriers and find what works best for you. You will be part of the project for the next 10 months. You gauge how technology can be integrated into your care package and how effective the new role of care technologist is in helping make that happen. As part of the project, we'll gather data that will be completely anonymous. The care technologist will speak to you about project consent and how the feedback will be collected during the 10 months. This will mostly be a series of questions that the care technologist will ask you at certain points during the project. So we really hope you feel as excited as we do about the opportunities this project offers. If you have any questions or concerns, please do ask us. This is a project we're embarking on together. We want it to be a useful, supportive, and creative addition to the care you already access. So thank you, and we really look forward to working with you.
Thanks. So I've got a few slides now. I'm going to stand for those. So the organisation I work for, Scottish Care, represents the independent social care sector in Scotland. So there's 97,000 people who draw on care and support every day in Scotland. And our members provide 75% of those services. So that's 350 members that we have. And they're providing over 900 services. So a question for you. Who here has ever struggled with technology? Everyone, right? Everyone. Yeah. So Let me ask you, how did it make you feel? Do you remember? So this morning, we were talking a lot about journeys and travel and getting around. I had my own little travel incident this morning when I, as I normally do, went onto the ScotRail app to buy my train ticket to come in here. I just come in from Helensburgh, it's not too far, nice and easy, or so I thought, until I got to the station and tried to activate my mobile ticket and found that I'd inadvertently bought a ticket that had to be collected at a manned station. Now, I don't live at a manned station. So I thought, okay, well, you know, it's fine. Get on the train, get on the train. So it's fine. And then I had quite a surly ticket inspector tell me that I'd bought the incorrect ticket. I'd done it wrong. And I said, well, you know, are you really going to make me buy another ticket? And you know, I think it was this close, actually. But I got away with it. I got to Exhibition Centre and the very kind staff there issued me with a paper ticket. And it was just one of those classic examples where it would actually have been easier if I just got on the train and bought a paper ticket off the inspector and technology hadn't worked for me because I'd just hit the wrong button. So I remember very clearly that that made me feel a little bit silly. So at Scottish Care, we believe technology should empower everyone, especially people who face barriers like sight loss, mobility issues, or cognitive changes. And we want to empower them to live independently with dignity and choice. So we make sure technology genuinely meets people's real world needs, respecting diverse abilities and lived experiences. So a little case study here from Gary. So personalised support transformed Gary's relationship with technology, restoring confidence and independence. So Gary is a gentleman who I know who has PCA, posterior cortical atrophy, which is a rarer form of dementia, which affects sight and orientation. In fact, Gary told me that he could get lost in his own living room. It was, you know, it was very debilitating for someone who had been a very practical person. He was initially overwhelmed by digital devices, and through working with a care technologist, he became empowered through voice-activated technology. And the impact for that on Gary was that safer navigation, you know, that we've been hearing about in the previous panels, that easier access to things he enjoyed, music, being able to communicate, having calls with his sister in London using his Google Home device. And he was able to overcome various challenges. His wife and his teenage daughter actually were severe hearing loss. So there was multiple sensory challenges in his home. And what the care technologist was able to do was work with him in a very personalised way to enable him to have more confidence and feel that once again technology was working for him. So we believe that technology can alleviate some of the challenges in the health and care system. So some of these challenges that we see in health and social care are limited support for digital inclusion. You know, there's a lot of work going on around that. We know that there's growing social isolation. And we know the effect of that is really debilitating. And we know that care coordination is really fragmented. So we don't have that joined up approach. So, for example, we think that technology can support and can be personalised and adaptive, and it can help individuals rediscover their independence after sight loss. So thinking about that kind of post-diagnostic application of technology. So you've heard about the care technologist. That was part of our future workforce roles that were in fact co-designed with people who draw on care and support and those who provide it. So thinking about that limited support for digital inclusion, well, you can have a care technologist who supports around that and those personalised technology solutions. Growing social isolation? Well, a care connector will connect you to community assets and things that are going on in your area. And that fragmented care coordination. Well, how about a care navigator who uses data to coordinate and optimise care. So this isn't the future. This is now. The little video said it was a 10-month project. We've in fact been doing this for several years now. And we've found the impact of the care technologist's role has been a social value return on every pound spent of up to about £8 if we do this at a larger scale. And potentially a 42% reduction in unmet care need. So if you're in any way watching the news, listening to the radio, you'll be aware that of the challenges around delayed discharge from hospital. You know, that friction in the system where people can't be where they need to be. So generally people should be at home where they want to be, but there are some blockages around that. So we are thinking about how roles like this can enable people to be at home in the community where they need to be. And thinking about how doing things differently, doing it in a human-enabled way that's scaffolded by technology, can actually reduce the costs of care. And, you know, the most important thing that is improve experiences and outcomes for people. So making that human-enabled care a reality, as I say, we've been trialling the role in Aberdeen, East Ayrshire, Glasgow, North Ayrshire, and in fact, the role is now being rolled out in England. And we have cross-sector partnerships, so particularly with social housing and with the Scottish Consortiums for Learning Disabilities. There's a very open invitation to RNIB, come and collaborate with us. And we're exploring an AI care navigator role with research partners. So Edinburgh University, in fact, helping us around that. And part of the ambition of that is to do something that's scalable. So, you know, there many of us are working in care, but there's not enough of us. And we have, you know, growing needs to provide social care and support. So really we're thinking about what the opportunities are for technology to reach people where there can't always be people, humans there. So yeah, an invitation. Let's design the future together. We think that technology implementation, health and social care needs to be really carefully designed by humans. If you're interested in continuing this conversation, please do look me up. And I will hand over. Thanks, Ruth.
Do you want to take the view? So, sorry.
Do you want to introduce first or her?
Thank you so much. Thank you, Nicola. I really, really appreciate that. And I think a really valuable example of genuine co-design that's come right through that process, through to implemented in practice and an incredible return on investment through the evaluation work as well. Now, next, very, very pleased to welcome Ruth Hamilton, who has joined us on behalf of Dr. Ian Livingston, who wasn't able to make it this afternoon. So very grateful to Ruth for stepping in. Ruth is a consultant clinical scientist within NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde, and also an honorary associate professor at the University of Glasgow. And Ruth is going to share a little bit more around from a clinical innovation perspective, particularly on home vision testing. So I'll hand over
Thank
to
you.
Ruth.
Thank you so much. I hope you can hear me. Thank you, Tara. I have slides too, so I'm just going to mosey over here and hopefully they'll be visible. So yes, I'm Ruth. I am a scientist. I don't wear a white coat and I am about 5'6" and I'm blonde, but that takes a lot of investment. And just to let you know what Ian is like, he's a very nice man and very good at getting favours out of people at short notice. So... today I'm going to talk to you about a project which is an example of where innovation came into routine vision care, which I hope you're going to find quite interesting. And Ian always overruns in his talks, and these are his slides. So there's about a half an hour's worth here, so I'm going to be skipping stuff, okay? So this really came around because in ophthalmology we've got this crisis because there is an increasing demand in service and there are fewer and fewer staff that are trained to do the stuff that we need to do, especially in paediatric ophthalmology. At the same time, we all know the rate that technological advance is happening, and we are also not only expected to, but we ought to be delivering person-centred care. That's our jobs in the NHS, and all of those represent changes. And we're going to talk to you today about a condition called amblyopia. Apologies to those of you who are familiar with this, and how that interacted with this perfect storm of changes, particularly around the time of COVID. Now, amblyopia is the term that we give to what we call a lazy eye, one eye that doesn't see as clearly as the other one. It affects a lot of individuals. It's a really high prevalence disease. 1 to 4% of children doesn't sound very much. The denominator is enormous. So this is a big problem. And because of one eye not working very well, there is this enhanced risk of losing vision because of an accident or illness that affects the other better eye. And that risk of permanent visual loss is therefore increased in people who have what in childhood is a relatively benign issue. We can fix amblyopia. It's based on early diagnosis and simple, inexpensive treatment. It's really cheap. This is not Luxturna with a $1 million injection. This is a pair of glasses or persuading, bribing a child to wear a patch for a few months, maybe longer, of their lives, or even giving them eye drops. The trick is you occlude the good eye and you train the brain to learn to see the sharp images coming through the eye that wasn't so good. All right? It's very effective. You need to get the kids diagnosed before they're about 7 or 8, and then you've got massive effectiveness. On top of that, in Scotland, we have a preschool vision screening programme, which is the Rolls Royce. It is better than is run anywhere else in the UK or almost the world. It's called See for School. It's run by orthoptists. Its coverage is almost 90%, which is very high for a universal screening programme. And that allows us to identify the children with amblyopia in time to treat them effectively. So far, so good. We've talked about this. Now, the delays in amblyopia monitoring, this is where we have to mention the COVID word, and indeed equity of access, and I'll talk more about this. But before we consider those, we need to talk about the burden on patient care. I don't think it's something that we're very good at talking in the NHS. We think if we send you an appointment, you will just rock up and drop everything. And if you have to bring your kid every 6 weeks to the hospital, that's fine. You don't mind them missing a day of school. You don't mind taking yourself out of work for a day in order to make that happen. It's not good, obviously, and it is a big burden. And even though this treatment is cheap, we need to keep testing these kids' vision to check we're being effective. And therefore, we need you to bring your kid to all these hospital appointments. It's a massive burden, again, because of the size of the denominator here. So we can do it better. This is what typically happens. These are the sort of card tests. This image is showing the traditional card tests that we use to test kids. We actually use digital versions. We're a wee bit past that in the hospital. We still use these. And these are the ones with letters on them or pictures. And we ask the kid to either say or point to a card saying, what have you seen? And this is how we test their visual acuity. And a really key part of assessing the effectiveness of amblyopia therapy. So what Ian decided to do, and Ian's very much, I've got a great idea, I'm just going to go ahead and do it till somebody tells me I should stop or I shouldn't have done it that way. And I'm much more on the, you know, there's research governance in place here, Ian, what we actually need to do is X, Y, Z and so on. But despite that push and pull, what we did was we tested, first of all, the Fredna shed. That's actually quite a route. It was really, really good. This was just a wee prototype tool where we left the patient in their home with a parent or a carer, and remotely we set up images for them to look at on their computer, and we used that to test their acuity. Okay, so we tried that out and we got a better version of it. We brought companies in, we did a competitive, what we call an SBRI, Small Business Research Initiative, and that got money from Innovate UK, and we got two fantastic companies on board, and they started building systems that did it much better than ours could. Did really practical things, like it could see if the kid was peeking. You know, it could tell if the kid had run up and was like sitting 60 centimetres away from the screen instead of a couple of metres back, and so on. And we tested these out, but over 250 kids across a number of different sites. And the bottom line is we found that the digital home versions were as accurate as what we were doing in the hospital. And there were other benefits. So I'm just showing a picture here. This is what it looks like. It's a laptop, and one of our orthoptists has got her list of patients she's got to call at home with a video call, and that would just run through for them. They would make connection with the family. The picture is now just showing the orthoptist connecting with the family at home on the screen before they start the test. Next stage of it would be actually starting to run the test, and the computer screen is just showing here what the orthoptist, the clinician sitting in the hospital, is looking at when she's running the test with all the different letter sizes that she's ready to show. And in the corner, she's got a screen that's showing her live video of what the kid is doing at home. Again, can see if they've pulled the patch off or have just run out of the room altogether. Always a risk. And then final video is just a close-up of the kid at home for you so that you can see how well our orthoptists are able to check. It's a quality check on how good the system is working. And that two-way communication is maintained all the time. Really important, obviously. We had this really cool system, the OptiNet, set up. And the picture here is showing you how digitally the... it's not AI, this is just simply algorithmic face monitoring, is monitoring exactly how far away that child is sitting from the screen. It's not a tape measure along the floor. They're looking at the distance and the cardinal points on the face and keeping accurate tabs on how far away the children is. And you can then adjust during the test if the kid's not staying exactly the same distance. So all of those improvements came about because we had companies engaging with us to deliver the solutions to the problems that we were describing to them. And we wanted to summarise here just what worked for you. So we knew the test worked. OK, if you got this number for your acuity when you got tested in the hospital, the number was pretty much exactly the same if you did one of the home testings. It was accurate. It was repeatable. It was easy to use. Don't get me wrong, setup problems were always part of the issue. And there, we worked really interactively with the companies to get over those and to find solutions for those so that we could proceed better. Really good things. The test time was much shorter. So an orthoptist sitting in a cupboard, actually, in one case, in one of our hospitals, could get through twice the number of kids in an afternoon clinic or in an evening clinic or on a Saturday clinic. Nobody was out of school. Nobody was out of work. We saw more kids. And that was really great. Nobody got in their car. Carbon footprint reduction, not quantified, but goes from whatever it would be to zero because nobody's in their car. Now, the ones that we've developed are not the only ones out there. There are others, DigiViz, Complog, and so on. And it's growing all of the time, absolutely all of the time. Well, one of the things we were really keen on was dealing with this issue of inverse care. So inverse care, I'm sure you know, this is where the least the segment of the community with the fewest advantages tends to get the worst deal in terms of healthcare. And I talked about our screening programme having almost 90% coverage. You can imagine who the 10% of kids are that didn't make it to their screen because of whatever complications were going on in their family life, socially, financially, and so on. We also know that it's that 10% that we miss that are most likely to have the problems and therefore the most likely to carry higher risks going on through life of carrying a lifelong burden of visual impairment. So, digital divide and tying in really nicely with what we came back to. Actually, one of the amazing things our project discovered was you didn't need a fancy laptop. You don't need a really nice device to do this on. People could do this on the family old Samsung. It worked on a mobile phone, that being one of the few technologies that not all, but most families do have access to. So we know that still that doesn't cover everybody, and that's another issue that we need to continue to tackle as we develop technical and digital solutions to deliver healthcare better for children. Right, I'm going to skip this. Future developments. So Ian is all about scaling, and he's got about 24 different ideas of how we could be doing this. Loads of tests. Yes, you need to come into your hospital for it. No doubt about that. But there's a whole bunch there that we can do safely and effectively without you getting in your car or going to a hospital. And scaling those with companies, with ophthalmological input, with scientists' input, is so helpful in terms of improving the quality of care for everybody else and for us, accessible information to find out how you're getting on, what we should be doing better to help you. Okay, this is a cute wee picture of a wee boy doing a vision test on his iPad. So he just looks for a target and presses where he sees it on the screen. It's exactly the same as the preferential looking test that you do, but an example of how you can implement really easy, child-friendly vision tests into devices. You have them, the quality assurance that they've been through the correct clinical and research governance procedures, and they're there and ready and usable for everyone. And this wee guy is just doing all this on an iPad sitting on the table in front of him. So I'll finish up there for now. If you have questions, there's Ian's email address. And I do have to acknowledge this is such a massive team effort. So, and particularly our funder, or one of our funders, the R.S. McDonald Charitable Trust. Thanks so much for listening, folks. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ruth. And I think excellent examples of the innovation in the space and support. I think those benefits you talked about as well just really emphasise how important taking that very person-centred approach is when we're thinking about future developments in the space. So thank you, Ruth. And finally, I'm delighted to speak this afternoon with Alan Stewart, who is a volunteer campaigner with RNIB Scotland and who brings lived experience expertise, particularly coming through ophthalmology services, but also reflecting on your experience of accessing health and social care services in general. So, Alan, do you want to tell us a little bit about your reflections and experiences from your expertise?
Thank you very much, Tara. My name's Alan, old, blind, Glasgow guy, distinguished silver hair, dark blue shirt, tweed waistcoat, tartan tie, blue jeans, blue thread shoes with pink laces. It says up there, Alan Stewart volunteer. It's actually Alan Stewart volunteered. A few years back, Laura from RNIB Scotland phoned me up and said, Alan, they're doing an eye care pathway for glaucoma. Would you be the patient rep on it? I said, well, I don't know what that is, but put me forward for it. Basically, what was happening was eye care is changing. Glaucoma is one of the very prevalent conditions that is actually relatively predictable and relatively manageable. And very often, most of the tests that you get can be done. It can be detected by your optometrist. Basically, the pathway used to be, go into your optometrist, there's a problem, get referred to your GP. GP refers you to ophthalmology. Ophthalmology tells you whether or not you've got glaucoma and decides on the services you get to support, whether that's eye drops, whether that's operations, SLT. Now, the way ophthalmology is changing is optometrists on the high street generally have got much better kit than the ophthalmology sections in the hospitals. And very often, the highly qualified optometrists are very able to provide more of those treatments. So surely it makes sense that more of those treatments can be delivered in the high street where people have got great trust in their optometrist rather than sitting in a hospital waiting room waiting to see an ophthalmologist just to be told, oh, everything's fine, come back in 6 months. Personally, in terms of that pathway, I look forward to the day that I can go home, take out my phone, measure my intraocular pressure, take a photograph, send it to my ophthalmologist, and if there's a problem, I get called in. That's the way I hope the future goes for the glaucoma treatment. Now, one of the things that's really important is people with visual impairment, I'm registered severely sight impaired, but I don't just use ophthalmology. I also need to access general healthcare services, whether that's the screening processes such as bowel cancer. That's I'm down here doing a bowel cancer screening test. Yeah. Try doing it when you're blind. So it's easy this way, maybe I ask no questions, right? Right. So when you're doing that when you're blind, so we use those services as well. Additionally, my mother is 92 years old and has Alzheimer's. And over the past number of years, we've had to place her in a care home. So we use services as carers. We visit friends. And indeed, we may have other health conditions. So how we access healthcare services can do the same as everyone else. But the hitch is we're visually impaired. So sometimes we need to look at how we do it a bit differently.
Absolutely. Thank you, Alan. And do you think there's practical things that our services can be doing to support in much better ways when we're thinking about inclusion and accessibility and digital?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is it's about sharing information, right? Yes, we can have all the platforms and tech that we want, but if the optometrist and ophthalmologist can't share the information electronically, then it slows the process down. Mm-hmm. However, given that optometrists are private companies, private practitioners, and the health service are dealing with health records, there has to be very careful information sharing protocols. So it's not that it can't be done, it just needs to be done properly. But there's also elementary things, like when you go to a hospital. I was at the low vision unit in Gartnavel, and health settings, every time you see a notice board, there's always posters up about various different things. In the low vision unit, some of the posters were pink, with light blue text, laminated, reflecting light. So even in the low vision unit, couldn't read the public information that was posted. Things like prescriptions. Ever tried reading what the symptoms might be from prescriptions? Nightmare. So there's simple things that can be done better.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Alan. Really appreciate your contributions this afternoon and bringing your perspective. I'm just conscious of the time because I know we're getting very, very, we're kind of over time, a bit close to the end. Maybe I'll just ask a couple of questions and then I'll come to the audience. So Nicola, I might come to you. Thinking about, you know, within the care technologist work and with the increasing availability of technologies and advancements in AI, and just thinking about what Alan was mentioning there around information sharing, how do we balance the potential of these technologies and innovations when we're thinking about protecting individuals' rights, ethics, autonomy, informed choice? Have you got any reflections on that from you?
That's a big question. That's like the world.
I know, sorry, it's 5 o'clock.
So I think there's massive potential around AI, or, you know, your comment was the solution you'd introduced wasn't, in fact, AI. You know, it was using algorithms, but it wasn't, you know, a kind of understanding of quite quizzy aspects of AI now. It's not always, in fact, needed. But I think what is really needed is to be really, really clear when we are using something that is AI enabled, and to be really, really clear what that is doing with our data, and to enable people to understand and control their data. So I think it's, you know, why would we use it? Is it the best? Is it the best use of it? Are there other ways we can do this? How are we making sure we're including people in the design of these products or service innovations? So I think there's a lot of considerations around that, so that we need to instill people's trust and get their confidence. It's not, AI isn't going to save us. I think we need to think about that kind of human element, what humans enable and what can be then augmented by emerging technologies, things like AI, and then how humans have oversight of that, particularly the end user and what their understanding is of the system.
Thanks, Nicola. And Ruth, what would you like to see in terms of the next advancements in your field?
More funding for the NHS, sorry. What's going to come? So gene therapy, we have to mention it because it is enormous in the ophthalmic field, not in terms of numbers of individuals, but in the potential. I mentioned Luxturna for Leber's congenital amaurosis. I think there's something like 250 treated individuals worldwide now. But that's just the start of the wave. And there's something like 38 other clinical trials of gene therapy or gene neutral therapies already at clinical trial stage that may be coming through. So I always just want to say, ask your ophthalmologist, are there clinical trials for people with my diagnosis? Because I'm not sure that individuals with visual impairment diagnoses are terribly empowered to ask that. And that answer is often yes. You may not be able to help yourself, of course, but you may be able to help the next generations. And then just one final thing just about tech, because I know this is all about tech and it comes up over and over again, heard such good things. I don't know where the lady from Aberté is with gaming, but, you know, VR headsets for assessment. You know, you want to know what your visual field's doing. If you've got glaucoma, you can test that at home with a VR headset. And people like Meta and others are already interested in looking at the space. But if you're developing the tech, don't develop the tech without the people that need to use it being involved. And so often we see companies that have got fabulous ideas or universities that have got fantastic ideas. And they say, look, this will help your patients. They wouldn't even fit at the desk. Because you've designed it for an adult, it's not going to work for children. So in contrary to all of that I've just seen, we've heard so many good examples just this afternoon about where engagement with people with visual impairments is helping to develop better and better technical solutions. And I just think it's so key. And we just need to have that at the heart of everything that we're trying to do and going forward.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ruth. And Alan, I'm going to give you the last word. The pace of technology and how that's changing. What are your hopes around how that develops in terms of inclusion and accessibility?
Well, one of the things for me is using tech to identify people. Spoke very powerfully there about the 10% of children that are not getting these tests. It's also the same in adults, because one of the things, there was a slight mix-up with my eye drops once. I stayed in Crawfoot and there was two of one and none of another. And I said to the pharmacist, I said, excuse me, I think there's a wee problem here. Maybe someone else has got my Lumigan, which is the most basic eye drop for treatment of glaucoma. And the pharmacist said, no, you're the only one that gets those eye drops here. Now, that pharmacy serves half of Castmilk, all of Crawfoot, pretty much most of Sims Hill. I cannot be the only person, given the prevalence rates, dotting about with glaucoma. But too often, I think, too many people are reticent to go into an optometrist, despite the fact it's fantastic. Eye health check is free, has been since 2006. Absolutely brilliant. Picks up more than just visual. And we need to get more people going and doing it. But if you struggle week to week and you're shopping at Iceland, walking past a shop that says two for the price of one, £70, that's a barrier to go through that door. So we need to find ways of encouraging people, using the technology to get people to get tested, to get the diagnosis, and don't be frightened. Because many of the things, because I think people just think, well, I'm getting older, my eyesight's going to go anyway. Could be macular degeneration, so you really should be getting it tested. Could be glaucoma, could be retinopathy. So we need to get more people through the door to get them tested, and we need to use the technology for the professionals to talk to each other so that we get more people getting the service. Because ultimately, one of the things of many eye conditions is the earlier you catch them, the better you've got a chance of of either rectifying it or slowing it right down. By the time it gets to my stage, it's too bloody late. So I think one day I give money to Glaucoma UK for research. Give money to Sightsavers as well, because we're lucky living in modern Western liberal democracies, because I get a diagnosis for eye health from what iPad do I need, what iPhone do I need. 80% of the world don't have that option, right? So we need the technology shared. I do believe that one day, and I think it'll come soon, probably in my lifetime, that there will be either a stop or a cure for glaucoma. It's not going to be early enough to benefit me, because let's face it, give it to somebody younger before the damage is done, right? So I'm actually quite hopeful about the future for treatment of the condition that I have.
Thank you, Alan. And just before we close the panel, would there be any questions from the audience that you'd like to ask any of our panel members? We have some microphones. You have a question here.
Good afternoon. Jimmy from Edinburgh again. That was a very interesting session. And I've got a question which I would like to find the answer to for numerous reasons, because I've always been involved with Scouts and tried to encourage young people to take part in sport and outdoor activities. And due to the decline in the blind school education in Scotland and everybody in mainstream, we don't see the children anymore. So can anybody tell me how many blind children we have in Scotland?
I can't tell you the number, but I know someone who can. So in Scotland, we have quite a unique register called VINSIP, which is the Visual Impairment Network for Children and Young People. It's a voluntary register, and across the whole of Scotland, when children are diagnosed with a condition classifying them as visual impairment, they are asked if they want to be registered with this network, which carries a lot of benefits from them. So I'm sorry, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but I'm really happy to contact you and pass it on. I don't know how many of them are Scouts, though. I'm sure we don't ask that.
On numbers, I think it's not just numbers of children, it's numbers of adults with visual impairment, because, yes, there's a registered either partially sighted or severely sight impaired, but I don't know how many blind and partially sighted people there are in Scotland. I don't know that RNIB Scotland know. I don't know that the Scottish Government collate the statistics and publish the statistics. So maybe that's the kind of question we should be asking the Scottish Government.
Thanks, Alan. And we've got another question here.
Thank you so much for, again, Illustrious panel. I think it's Ruth. I mentioned a little bit earlier that we, in as much as the rehabilitation, we do eye health, and we have been looking at retinoblastoma. This is in Uganda, just to put it in context. And also, we work with Morfield, you know, doctors, but also we have been looking at retinopathy of prematurity. I saw that kid, that child, you know, and I was wondering how the setup, how old is the child, but also the was that an iPhone, you know? So what are the context is that, if we were to do the speed in Uganda, for example, in Africa, that might be one off, because so far we rely on, you know, somebody going there, waiting in here, and then kid might come. But if we can put them into their own hands or family hands and be able to report this or whatever they're sent to, you know, that might be, because these are very serious issues in this country. So, yeah, please, can you?
It's such a good question. I'll be quick. And perhaps we can pick this up offline, because I think there's probably a lot of synergies that we could work with. Retinopathy of prematurity, very severe, especially in developing economies. We're working on a lateral flow test to detect sight-threatening disease as well, which might be something that's of interest for connecting with. But in terms of using the tools I was describing today, I think it would be great if Dr. Livingstone and I connected with you and we discussed that further, if that's suitable. Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I'm so, so sorry. We've run out of time. Please join me in thanking our presenters this afternoon. Thank you so much to Alan, Ruth and Nicola. And thank you to you all for your comments and questions and for joining us. And hope you have a safe trip home. But I think we've got some final reflections. So I'll hand back over. Thank you.